Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm Heather Lucky Penny, your host and a senior fellow at the Mitchell Institute. Here on the Aerospace Advantage, we speak with leaders in the DoD, industry, and other subject matter experts to explore the intersection of strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So, if you like learning about aerospace power, you're in the right place. And to our regular listeners, welcome back. And if it's your first time here, thank you so much for joining us. As a reminder, if you like what you're hearing today, do us a favor and follow our show. Please give us a like and leave a comment so that we can keep charting the trajectories that matter the most to you. I've said it for a long time, if you don't have an Air Force, you can't have a Joint Force. Fundamentally, the way that we fight as a U.S. military is predicated on American air power and our coalition partners' air power, too. It's that global vigilance, global reach, global power. If deep strike, interdiction, close air support, air superiority, mobility, all of it. Within hours, the Air Force aircraft and airmen can be anywhere around the globe executing all of these missions. And not much else, aside perhaps from space power, can execute and respond to our nation's demands that rapidly. After all, ships move at 20 knots, and large ground forces take weeks and months to deploy. Given how fast circumstances develop around the globe, this rapid response is a game changer. Now, scale, numbers, quantity, this matters too. And that's why the Air National Guard is a key player in executing nearly every single mission assigned to the Air Force. Whether it's air superiority, air mobility, air medical evacuation, cyber, and more, Guardsmen are deployed around the globe every single day helping to meet COCOM demand. And they're also sitting alert here at home. This is the mission I use to execute. But the Air Guard is also facing challenges. Along with the rest of the Air Force, equipment is aging and we're not procuring replacements fast enough. This is especially pronounced in the fighter mission area. Jets procured in the 1970s and 80s are hitting the end of their service lives, and we're not buying enough F-35s and F-15EXs fast enough to replace them. COCOM demand is not going down, and that drives the remaining force even harder. It's a death spiral. I can't emphasize enough how serious this problem is and the need to work solutions. Budgets must respond to the global threat environment, because it's not going to happen the other way around. Unfortunately, the budget constraints are providing more pressure against the Air Force. CAPS currently in play are seeing the service buy less aircraft, not more. The Air Force is seeking to retire 250 aircraft, but they only have enough money to buy 129 new ones in the FY25 budget. This is Exhibit A on this front, and it's a trend that's been in play for years. In fact, a recent headline in Defense News asked, as the U.S. Air Force fleet keeps shrinking, can it still win wars? Our adversaries can count numbers, and so can our allies. This is a problem that demands real solutions. So, given that context, I'm really pleased to have Lieutenant General Mike Lowe, Director of the Air National Guard, with us today. He spent the last several years working these issues, not just admiring these problems, but really driving for fixes. I'm also excited to have Lieutenant General Gus Gostella, a longtime friend of the Mitchell Institute, with us for this conversation. And as you all know, he last served as Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, half A3 in the Pentagon. Gentlemen, thank you so much for making the time for this conversation.
Lucky, thanks to you and AFA for having me here. And Gus, it's always great to be with you.
Concur. Hey, Lucky and Mike, it's great to be on this with you, talking about the Guard, something I really care about, and talking about air power. So I'm excited to do this today for Mitchell Institute.
Okay, sir. Well, before we jump into the conversation, General Gostella, I frame the issue as I see it. So what's your take responding to this capability demand mismatch and what we can do to fix it and where the Air Guard fits into this equation?
You know, you're absolutely right that we have a capability demand mismatch, and it's especially bad today. So it's the worst it's been, and frankly, in our lifetime, in the sense that we have an ongoing conflict in the Middle East. You know, until the day where Persians, Arabs, and Israelis get along, there will be a need for military deterrent and sometimes offensive capability in the Middle East. It's not going away. So that's a steady demand signal. As a matter of fact, it's very high right now. Then you combine that with the war that Putin engaged in Europe. Our deterrent posture was not sufficient in Europe. Now we need more assets there. And then you combine that with our national ambitions of deterrence in the Pacific, and you can see air power spread too thin. And then when you overlay that demand, you compare that demand to what you just described, Lucky, which is a ever diminishing force size, both on the active and the reserve component guard on the guard side, it's creating a big problem for our nation. And it's something that we're going to have to address.
Absolutely. I mean, for our listeners, just to give you a little bit of history here, the Air National Guard is not a strategic reserve. That ended in the 1990s after the Cold War fell and the nation literally cut the Air Force in half. Active duty Air Force fighters were aggressively divested from the Air Force, and the Air National Guard had the wherewithal to be able to protect some of their fighter assets. So the Air National Guard actually comprises nearly 40% of the active of the total force fighter portfolio, and they stepped up to the game. So the Air National Guard is an operational reserve, and the total force can the Air Force cannot do its job without the Air National Guard. And so as we're seeing the service divest more aircraft and aggressively go after Guard force structure, because those are the oldest jets in the inventory, I believe this personally places our entire joint force at risk. So General Lowe, clearly I have some opinions about this, but would you mind painting a picture for us? Right now, as we speak, what missions is the Air Guard executing? Because I think it's really crucial that people understand the scale and the scope that your team members cover.
Yeah, let me start off by saying a couple things. First off, from my seat, there's always a continuous demand signal for the Guard. And that's even with the shifting size of the whole Air Force. I mean, you think about our role in NORTHCOM and the Homeland Defense Mission. The Air National Guard provides 94% of the Air Force's Homeland Defense 24/7, 365 mission. Airmen watch over the skies of North America, the Pacific, and Alaska, and keep U.S. airspace safe from threats. That's that aerospace control alert mission. And Lucky, you can speak to this. You talk about accessibility. When we hear stories about the military's response to 9/11, right, getting airborne within minutes after it was declared an attack on the U.S., it was the Air National Guard that was in place to protect Air Force One, secure the U.S. airspace, and stop the hijacked planes by any means necessary. And the Air Guard has stepped up to the plate time and time again. You look at what the Swamp Foxes did in the first Gulf War, you know, the mentality of the seed capability that they brought, first in, last out motto. Just our intelligence preparation of the battlefield and the targeting on E-8 JSTARS. But that continues today into the DGS missions that we perform in the country employed in place. The use of lightning pods for non-traditional ISR means, and of course, fielding new versions of AESA radars on F-15Cs and also on our F-16s, mainly in the pre-block F-16s. Our current work in cyber-enabled air superiority when we converted Mansfield, Ohio from a C-130 unit to a cyber unit. We answer the demand signal that is put on us by the combatant commanders. We're on the ground floor on some of these new mission sets and hardwares. And so the COCOM, they know what they're getting. They're getting the experience of the National Guard. Your intro mentioned aging equipment, and both you talked about that. This is actually still a major concern for us, but still, COCOMs want Guard in the fight. If you look at the A-10 deployment to CENTCOM currently, over 40-year-old aircraft, but that's just because of our airman track record. And then the other question that you asked, which was, hey, paint a picture for us today. The short answer is the Air Guard is in all of the missions. We're doing everything in the United States Air Force right now. Of course, we do it with a different force and a component. So it might be easier to figure out what we're not doing. I mentioned Homeland Defense and the AACA mission, but we have airmen employed in place, or equipment in place, if you want to think of it that way. They're carrying out mission a day in cyber and space domains for the United States. Airmen are executing intelligence, reconnaissance, command and control, offensive counter-terror, and counter-drug missions, right in our own United States, also deployed overseas. And then we have special operators trained in some of the most demanding missions that we have, securing airfields and developing new airfields around the world, and being part of the Air Force Special Ops Command. So we fly and support global strike operations. We just did the B-2 Elephant Walk that you all covered at AFA, and that was actually both active duty and guard units just not doing the elephant walk together, but flying off and employing the B-2 like it's meant to be tested in combat. From a standpoint of hardware, we currently provide 30% of the combat power for the greatest air force on the planet, with over 108,000 members, 27% of the fighter fleet, 38% of the mobility fleet, And of course, when you talk about combatant commander taskings, because Gus, you brought up CENTCOM, the demand signal never stops. And for 22, we filled 44% of the Air Force's combat taskings in CENTCOM, and nearly half right now, 47% in 23. And of course, 24 continues. And then the final piece that I'd like to bring up, the state partnership program, what we do for our international partners and allies around the world. We have over 107 relationships with over 107 countries, and we support the Combatant Command's geographic campaign plan in support of the national defense strategy around the world.
Sir, the fact that the Air National Guard is filling nearly 50% of COCOM taskings is a staggering number. I mean, that really just shows that not only is the Guard accessible, but the Guardsmen are willing and they want to do their mission. General Gostella, you were the A3, and when you were the Combined Forces Air Component Commander at CENTCOM, how did you see the Guard help fill this demand signal? I mean, it's just not going away.
You know what? I had nothing but phenomenal impression of our Guardsmen and our units that were deployed in the Middle East. I spent 4 years of my life in the Middle East, four plus, and worked through all of those years with a lot of Guard units. I'm talking Guard fighter units, Guard attack airlift units, tanker units, civil engineers. Just like Mike said, there wasn't a single mission area that the Guard wasn't involved in. And they did a great job. On the ops side, the Guard is used a lot of their own resources to evolve primarily the F-16, but all Guard platforms to answer the call for the war of our nations, which is the counterinsurgency, the close air support. That mission set was what we've been doing, had been doing for so long. The Guard did a phenomenal job keeping its jets up to speed for that fight and then performing well in the fight. And hats off also to our Guard maintainers, the technicians, the veteran maintainers, that if you give them the parts, they're going to keep those aged airframes flying. I think, as a matter of fact, some of the most effective squadrons in terms of sortie production or never dropping an ATO sortie, some of the records were set by the Guard units because of the experience they have on the maintenance side. So I had a really good impression of our Guard in the fight.
So I do have to ask you a little bit here, because there is often pushback from active duty leadership about accessibility to the Guard. When in reality, as we already said, the stats show and the facts show that the Guard is there, it is available. Can you explain a little bit, General Gostella, why there's this perception that there's no access to the Guard?
Well, it is a perception that's out there. You know, let me just give you an example. So, you know, we're very, consumed force, as you know. We have deterrent operations going on in the Pacific, certainly in Europe, and then we have active operations going on in the Middle East and the homeland defense. So a lot of times when a COCOM, with that is like a high ambient level, if you will, and there's suddenly an additional requirement for air power. Heck, I was in the Pentagon, and it was a previous chairman of the Joint Chiefs said, hey, why is it you have, 50, 60 fighter squadrons, why can't you send one more? They always seem to ask that. And so there is a perception that some of the force isn't accessible, but they don't realize that the deploy to dwell, the construct of the Guard, doesn't allow the exact same utilization that you have out of the active duty. But that's by design. And so, like Mike just described, look at the mission, the volume of the missions being done by the Guard. Clearly, they are accessible, and they're doing practically 50% of the tasking in for these COCOM deployments. And so here's the other issue, though, and that is they are accessible if we elect to mobilize them, right? Except for the most major campaigns, such as Desert Storm, Iraqi Freedom, there's been a reluctance by the Secretaries of Defense over the years to mobilize the Guard. But if they do so, they'd certainly be completely accessible. And so it's our construct that allows our Guardsmen to serve our nation, to retain that incredible expertise and be available selectively for the nation's needs, but also have the day jobs, interact with the American public. All those things are valued that the Guard brings.
You know, sir, the mobilization issue is crucially important. Having served myself, mobilization was the way that I was able to legally get the permissiveness from my employer and their understanding and support for me to actually go do the job. And that's crucially important if we want to be able to continue to retain this experience. But some interesting things I'd like for our audience to take is that, one, you talked about COCOMs and senior leadership in the defense saying, why can't you send one more fighter squadron? that tells me that fighters are in high demand, right? And when we're talking about deploy to dwell ratios, it also shows that not only is the active duty too small already when it comes to fighters, it tells me we cannot get any smaller on the guard side as well when it comes to fighters.
Yeah, and Lucky, I'll just pile on a couple things here. When you look at the Air Force generation model, we should be on the active component in a 1-3, you know, deploy to dwell, and on the reserve component in a 1-5 deploy to dwell. That gives us the max amount of readiness. But it is. It's a, what I would call, it's not an overconsumption by the COCOMs, but the demand signal's there. And so I'll also parrot the Secretary of the Air Force, Frank Kendall, who said, no kidding, to all the adjutant generals, I have no issues with guard readiness or guard accessibility. So he has made that a statement to all. So I take that as that the senior leadership of the Department of Defense knows exactly how to get to the guard when they need it. But this is a service issue. And I'm going to say this way. This is a total force, Air Force issue, but other services. You know, we're the only service cutting capacity. Mm-hmm. This is a budget problem, and it's a huge budget problem. I'm not saying anything that you haven't heard before, anything that everybody who just went down to Congress and the posture hearings was saying. But this spring, the Air Force announced it's going to get rid of 250 aircraft. That's equivalent to almost 14 fighter squadrons. Let me say that again. 14 fighter squadrons. We're down to under 5,000 aircraft in the Air Force. And in Desert Storm, we had 9,000, and they were new. So this is just a continual underfunding of our United States Air Force. And of course, when you look at the National Defense Strategy, it's pretty clear about threats to our national security and the steps that are required to deter them. We operate in a peace through strength paradigm. We bring peace to the world through our strength of our military, and that must continue. So when you look at it, we need an Air Force that'll be modern, fully capable joint force in order to deter our adversaries. And that means an appropriate size, okay? The majority of what I've been looking for and fighting for these last 4 years as the director of the Air National Guard is getting out of these legacy fleets. You know, the legacy fleets is defined by the Air Force. F-16 is a great aircraft. It was a great aircraft when I learned to fly it before some of our airmen are even born, right? Our allies and partners are flying Block 70 F-16s, and we got squadrons still flying Block 30s or pre-blocks. These planes were built in the 80s. We need a modern Air Force, and that's across the total force, active guard, and reserve.
You know, sir, you talked about the Block 30s, and that's what I flew as well, what we flew together as well. A lot of folks don't realize that when, during the 1980s, during the Reagan-era defense buildup, he wasn't actually building up the Defense Department. He was transforming the Defense Department. He was buying fighters at a rate of 200 to 300 jets a year so that he could divest the Century Series fighters and the world worn out long in the tooth fighters from Vietnam. And so because we bought that many at that rate, 200 to 300 a year, that's the rate at which they're dying now. And actually, they should have already been in the boneyard well over a decade ago. And so because we're not procuring at a one-for-one rate, and this is all budget-driven, that's why we're seeing this incredible capability and demand mismatch.
Yes, so the problem of being a force which is too small, it will equate to losing. But what is losing, right? It's hard to actually envision. What is losing? Well, for starters, losing equals not deterring, an inability to deter. We've seen that already. And we had an inability to deter Iran and its proxies in the Middle East. We're struggling with a deterrent presence in the Pacific. If you remember, the budget-driven cuts took 48 fighters out of Kadena, and now we're having to replace those with a rotational presence of a smaller force, which it drives up the ops tempo. So we're struggling to deter, and as we get smaller, losing equals no deterrence, okay? But there's more. When you're too small, you're also unable to assure your allies and partners. A lot of countries in the Middle East want assurance from the United States that we're going to be there, that we can help defend them, and that we will create a deterrent posture from their countries to deter bad actors in the region. When we don't have the capacity to demonstrate the assurance, we lose those allies. They may turn to others. They may turn to China, right? And so capacity affects us more than a lot of folks just realize. And then lastly, when the force is too small, and it's overconsumed as we are right now, you kill readiness. Not in the sense that they can't, you know, go do the missions that they're doing each day, but you don't have the time on the calendar to prepare for the high-end fight. When you're deployed to the Middle East, when you're sitting on an island in the Pacific, yes, you're deterring, but are you training at the level you need to be for a high-end fight? The answer is no. So a force that's too small fails to deter, it fails to assure, and the readiness diminishes. And that is the problem that we have with the total force right now. Enough on that problem. What are you guys doing on the guard side to try to help Vectrus in a solution? Where does the guard fit into this mix?
Hey, Gus, I'm cheering you, as you can tell, you know, silently sitting here listening to exactly the points that we make. And when deterrence fails, the National Defense Strategy says we must dominate in conflict. And so when you have a force that can't actually do that also, you have that double whammy, and that's kind of where we're sitting. So what are we trying to do? Quite simply, it's a modernization effort. We need the same modern lethal hardware that the active duty fighter units are getting and our allies and partners are getting. Our ability to assess new systems helps close those critical capability gaps with peer competitors and upholds that deterrence that we've all mentioned around the globe. This means ensuring that all our airmen are flying modern airplanes now, concurrent modernization with the rest of the Air Force, and our strongest allies and partners. You know, when you look at the numbers, and I'll just give you some numbers, 15 of our 25 fighter squadrons are flying legacy platforms, okay? That means they're not in the F-35, F-15EX, the F-22, or scheduled to receive next-generation air dominance systems. The Air Force Reserves needs modern aircraft as well, so it's a double whammy on both the Guard and Reserve here. When the active duty, Guard, and Reserve all have up-to-date hardware, we combine to build a stronger Air Force, and that maintains the peace throughout the world. Okay, but of course, it's not just fighters. I mean, we are still operating the nation's second tanker. The second tanker. Think about that. We have built, you know, more than two tankers in this nation, but the Air Guard is still operating the KC-135, which is older than any of us in this room. You know, a strong version of an Air National Guard means that we have KC-135s and C-138s recapitalized into KC-46s and C-130Js. And then when we talk about concurrent fielding of weapon systems, let's look at where we're going in the future, because I think that's where we need to go. In the future, with things like CCAs and B-21s and new airlifters, next-generation airlifters, next generation of tankers, we need to start early and get it in on the ground floor with active guard and reserve working together to define the requirements of where we go in the future and also to help build and test and operationalize these systems and make sure we do that. It's imperative for our Air Force, but also for the Joint Force. Utilizing that Guard experience and the Guard airmen that are trained and ready on the newest systems will propel us into the future.
General Lowe, I'm really glad you brought up what happens when deterrence fails, because that's when you end up with warfare that looks like Ukraine, which is based off of attrition-based warfare, two-dimensional land for warfare, which is just attrition and atrocities. Basically, whoever has the most bodies and bullets wins. And this is not good for anyone because it fundamentally wrecks economies, the land, communities, families. It is far more gruesome than the kind of warfare that we employ as the U.S. Air Force, as a joint force and with our coalition partners, because air power changes that dynamic, which is one of the reasons why the Air Guard is so important to have as an operational reserve that provides strategic depth to the nation. COCOMs are demanding this every single day, and the Air Force, the active component, and the reserve component are providing that bench of air power. But we've got to be able to surge with elasticity when that demand really strikes. And I'm concerned about that strategic depth. We've got to be able to recapitalize, modernize, and grow on a budget. We've all talked about the budget constraints and how that's causing us to shrink the force. We've got to also then be able to maintain the experience that's banked across the entire enterprise. General Lowe, what are your thoughts on this?
Sure. I would change that a little bit, just say that we are an operational reserve. I mean, you mentioned it at the first, so we're operational reserve with strategic depth. And I think the listeners, I mean, three-fourths of the folks that are out there manning these combat formations are actually part-time. They're drill status guardsmen, okay? So that 70% have another job or career outside the military. They see problems differently, which is good because that diversity of thought is absolutely an incredibly powerful thing. We have Air National Guard personnel in places like DIU and DARPA, industry and the like. They're busy professionals juggling multiple careers and commitments. Simply put, their patriotism is unparalleled. And when combined with the breadth and depth of their experience, that's that powerful combination that can propel us not only for that brunt force, but also that strategic depth necessary for America. In the most recent RAND study that they just put out, I found that the reserve components, Guard and Reserve, personnel provide a workforce with more experience and qualifications than their active counterparts. It just makes sense, right? But in all four missions, every measure that RAND put together, they looked at this. The reserve component fighter pilots averaged twice the experience level of the active component. Our tanker crews, our fighter crews are more experienced. And then the maintainers. Gus, you mentioned it, but actually RAND went out and put the numbers to it. 44% more 7 levels compared to the active component. These are folks that know how to maintain aircraft and get them back flying and actually take the necessary risk that a pilot is willing to accept. And so those are the things where I say, hey, we're an operational reserve, but we do have that strategic depth, that 3/4 of the force that is in another business area that's maintaining the same readiness standards as the active component. We've been at this. You look at the testing that has gone on in the longest conflict our nation has ever experienced with CENTCOM, Iraq and Afghanistan, and we've come out with a very seasoned and experienced force. Some of those same seasoned experienced force when I started out years ago came out of Vietnam. And those are the ones that trained me to get ready for what would become the next battle, which is CENTCOM.
Mike, that experience matters a lot. And I love the way you described that. But it matters also for more than just U.S. air power. The experienced airmen in the Guard play a unique role supporting our partners and allies. And you mentioned it earlier through the state partnership program. And it's been crucial to the support of Ukraine's defense. Can you talk a little bit about the state partnership program a little bit more in depth?
Sure. And you're right. The highlight was Ukraine, because I think that actually elevated the state partnership program. But it's been going on for over 30 years. It's one of the Pentagon's most cost-effective security cooperation programs. States partner and train with our international foreign country partners from around the world. And these engagements turn into more of a whole-of-country effort. It's diplomacy, it's soft power, it's relationship building, and then, of course, technical training rolled into one. The tactics, techniques, and procedures that have been utilized in Ukraine in order to do air power and deliver air power over that battle zone means that nobody has air superiority right now. And lucky you're right, that is a bloody conflict. A lot of these partnerships are 30 years old. Right now, we have partnerships with 107 countries. Finland just joined the program as a new state partner with Virginia. And so when something happens in the world, the Air National Guard has these relationships that already exist. You mentioned Ukraine. Every day I look at the number, it's 799 days of conflict today. No one has air superiority. And so right now, we're training Ukrainian pilots on how to fly F-16s. We have 12 in training down at Tucson in the 162nd Fighter Wing at Morris Air National Guard Base in Tucson. And so that critical capabilities and expertise builds partnership capacity through training programs that enhance combat capabilities of our allies and partners, as Ukraine continues to defend against Russian aggression in the region. But it's also not all about that. When I was the Adjutant General for Colorado, Colorado had two key partners, Slovenia and then Jordan. Slovenia credits us to this day with bringing the Slovenian Armed Forces up to NATO standards, now a full member of NATO, and now ability to actually surge air power anywhere in the world from the Slovenian Armed Forces, and especially their special forces. And then, of course, in Jordan, bringing their capabilities and the F-16 capabilities up, their fighter pilots, their maintainers, and allow Jordan to actually go out of area and help us out when we're doing Operation New Dawn down in Libya. So those partnerships allow us to build air forces around the world and allow us to also work with the other components, land, maritime components of a different country, to say, hey, here's what our air power. So the access basing and overflight that we have in those countries is absolutely essential to build a stronger joint force and especially a stronger Air Force.
You know, Mike, I got to share a quick story. So I'm in Romania. This is years ago, and I'm there in a NATO capacity. I'm meeting with the Romanian Air Chief, and he asked me in the conversation, "Hey, Gus, where are you from?" And I told him I was from Alabama, and he lit up. He goes, "Alabama?" He goes, "I've been fishing in Lake Martin." I'm like, "How have you been fishing in Lake Martin in Alabama?" He goes, "Because, you know, I had this great relationship with the Alabama Air National Guard." And he lit up and talked about the years that the Romanians have been working with Alabama and developed friendships and relationships. And this guy now has become the chief, had become the chief of the Romanian Air Force. So, you know, with those relationships that were built by the Alabama Guard, that state partnership program lasted decades. It helped Romania transition from former Soviet equipment and a Soviet style Air Force to what they're doing now, which is even aspiring to move to the F-35, which Alabama now has. And so I just want to reiterate how important I think and how valuable that partnership program is for our nation.
Yeah, Gus, hey, thanks. I looked at the budgets the other day, you know, because we've been putting those together for the last 4 years. The state partnership is 1% of the nation's security cooperation budget, but results in 20 to 30% of the touch points or engagement that combatant commanders have out there in the numerous theaters. I mean, this is really, we talk about deterrence, we talk about peace through strength, but it's also peace through strength and partnerships around the world. Thanks for recognizing that.
Absolutely.
So gentlemen, I got to step in here because we're talking a lot about the state partnerships and that kind of diplomacy and relationship and those touch points are going to be really crucial, not just as we've seen in Europe, but also as we look to the future towards the Indo-PACOM theater and agile combat employment, which as we know, possesses a significant portion of the pacing threat and of a strategy within that theater. So General Lowe, I'd like to ask you about how the Air Guard plays into agile combat employment and America's aerial mobility capability.
Okay, sure. Just a couple things. So much like our fighter force, our mobility forces are sitting alert today and actually are engaged globally in the worldwide logistics enterprise. So they're out there today. I've pulled data before and I've looked at the different countries that we're operating in and out of. It's anywhere between 100 and about 125 on a daily basis is where you can find Air National Guard airmen. When you look at agile combat employment, the first thing is that access basing and overflight. We need to make sure that. So the state partnership program obviously allows those partners to develop. And then when you look at the contingency response teams, those teams that go out, we have done a lot of work on agile combat employment to deliver capabilities in unique ways and expand the joint force and where the joint force can go. For example, last winter up in Nome, Alaska, we sent the 123rd Contingency Response Group up in the wintertime to Nome, Alaska, and expanded their ability to accept military aircraft in Nome, obviously expanding the number of airfields that can be opened in there. When you look at the exercises we did, like Air Defender, the largest NATO exercise in its history and a transatlantic movement, we were taking our mobility planners and setting up the airlift, the air bridge, from the continental United States straight into Europe, and how we would actually deliver combat air power, not just the mobility side of it, not just the short tons and the cargo, but also the fighters, the F-16s, the F-35s, the A-10s, F-22s. And so having that mobility bridge was there. Gus and I, well, we all have lived through the days where we had delays in the AOS movements, you know, sometimes days, sometimes weeks. We're not going to get the jets back for weeks. But in this, we delivered it on time, 100%. And that was just due to the unique mobility, the planning side, and also the volunteerism out of our units. We had 52 units participate in Air Defender. I think that was unbelievable time in June to get everybody over there and do the largest NATO exercise and send a clear message to Putin, do not cross the NATO line. So that was the first one. Then we shifted in July to Mobility Guardian, right? Supporting out there the total force and how we would set a theater up and maneuver out in the Indo-Pacific. So we also participated in Mobility Guardian and the Agile Combat Employment events where we would take CR forces combined with Special Tactics forces to go in and open new airfields and work with the local populace in small teams in order to say, hey, what is here? What can we utilize? and how can we do this? Now, Agile Combat Employment for the Air National Guard is being handled at the local and regional level, and then in the big exercises, mentioned Air Defender and Mobility Guardian. But even in our local training, I was up in the Northeast, talked about the Northeast Tanker Task Force, but on a weekly basis, twice a week, they get together and they bring assets like KC-46s and 135s, along with support personnel and MQ-9s and F-15s and F-35s, and they all come together to go out there, bring small teams in, do combat turns in other areas to build upon that. And then, of course, we've morphed it into our larger exercises like Northern Strike, Northern Lightning, Lightning Century Savannah, and Century Loha. So every exercise that we're doing right now, we're getting involved in the Agile Combat Employment on how we would do these integrated combat turns under fire.
Sir, I think some of the statistics that you mentioned there regarding the performance of your airmen in Air Defender and Mobility Guardian are really important, not only for their excellence in mission execution, but their participation as well. And I think this speaks a lot to the importance of the Air National Guard within the whole life cycle of service that an airman has from the time they access into the active component to choices they may have to make later on. For example, I was a guardsman because I needed to make choices for both my family and my service. But I think it's really important to understand how the Air National Guard fits into the life cycle of service and the total force, allowing us to be able to capture the expertise, the experience, and the skill sets of airmen who may not be able to retain within the active component.
First off, we need strong leadership and strong retention in all three components. So the active duty Air Force, we absolutely need strong leaders to stay in the active duty Air Force. Mm-hmm. And if it works out, and I've done a lot of mentoring of our active duty members and asking them, because they'll normally come to me, hey, I'd like to join the Guard. And my first question is why? You know, because I do believe that, again, I'm a product of a father that stayed in the active duty for 35 years. And so, and of course, I also have a son that's in the active duty. So I think that we absolutely need the active duty. And then the two reserve components, you know, people join the Air National Guard like you did for a variety of reasons, often stemming from a desire to serve, right? In the National Guard, serve their community, serve their state, while also serving their country, and maintaining a civilian career, pursuing education, receiving some valuable skills, going out and doing something different than what they did. But I really do believe they're drawn to that sense of duty. You know, what I would call is, hey, I attribute everything I've done to the United States Air Force. And now how can I continue to serve the United States Air Force with the other things that are going on in my life? And so it's the best thing that we could do is have that. Obviously, we fight, and you've seen it on Congress, we fight for additional benefits, including health care and educational assistance. But those things that are offered by the Air National Guard and offered at the state level have been significant for those seeking stability and professional development. It also allows us then to build a very diverse force, you know, source from around the nation, you know, as far west as Guam, sourcing that air power from Guam, you know, as far northeast as Maine, and then, of course, Alaska all the way down to Puerto Rico. That diversity that we bring to the United States Air Force is also a key point. And then, of course, you mentioned one of the reasons, but when they leave the active duty, what I tell them is there's probably a local community that you can serve in. Where are you from? Do you want to go back to that part? Or do you want to experience something different because of the good educational opportunities in some other part of the country? We have 166 locations. And, you know, I just took a C-17 pilot who had a engineering degree. And he goes, I don't want to be in the C-17. I said, well, what would you like to do? He goes, I'd like to use my engineering degree. I said, perfect. How would you like to join a civil engineering squadron? We'll send you the right pat and get you retrained. And so, you know, if you found yourself in an AFSC that you may get out of in the active component, come join a guard unit, come do that, and we may be able to get you into something else in order for you to continue to serve your country and serve your Air Force.
Sir, I love that story because not only does it speak to the flexibility that the Air National Guard has to be able to retain experienced airmen across all AFSCs, but it also really shows the multi-capable airmen that the Air National Guard has that may not necessarily have those in their AFSC, but have it in their civilian career and have it in their background.
Oh, yeah. And when you look at it, the community that we serve in actually rallies around the mission of the United States Air Force. I mean, you know, if you go up into and the Springfield, the Westover area, you know, they're rallying around the new thing of an F-35. If you go to Mansfield, Ohio, Mansfield is an interesting one. It went from C-130s, right? That's how they identified themselves in the past, and now they're into cyber. Ohio State is actually expanding the number of cyber courses that they offer because of the Mansfield connection. So getting the Air Force story and having an entire community rally around an Air Force mission area, I think, is also powerful.
So you mentioned cyber in Ohio, and so I'm gonna dig on that a little bit more, because we're seeing a lot of new Air Guard mission growth in the cyber area. I know it gets classified really fast, but at the macro level, what do these cyber missions look like, and what sort of folks are we recruiting to execute them? I mean, it's very sophisticated talent, and it comes from very specific communities, especially given the educational cultivation that's required within those universities. So you mentioned that with Ohio State, as well as the jobs that they would be required to be able to sustain as a part-time guardsman.
Yep. It is a growth area. It's a growth area we've actually been working on for many years. And so, you know, the Air Force constantly evolves to the threat, and we've seen the threat of what cyber can do. And so we've coined the term cyber-enabled air superiority and how we deliver that via cyber. But I should also point out that the Air National Guard is no stranger to the cyber mission. We already conduct 62% of Air Force's cyber mission, 62%. So two-thirds of what the Secretary of the Air Force could call on for cyber is coming out of your Air National Guard force. We have members engaged 24-7 on cybersecurity operations, safeguarding sensitive information, critical infrastructure from cyber threats. You know, this includes things like conducting network defense, monitoring for intrusions, and responding to cyber incidents to ensure the integrity and resiliency of the DoDIN, of our military systems. Moreover, we play a vital role in offensive cyber operations. Everyone loves to jump to offense, you know, and I call it the very small niche, but it's a little bit more than that. But we do employ advanced techniques to counter adversaries and disrupt their capabilities. Through continuous training, collaboration with government agencies, other government agencies, industry partners, the Air National Guard does remain at the forefront in defending our nation's networks and also trying to continue that development into the digital domain. On the human piece, we all know what the what a exceptional cyber operator who is well-trained in the military, well-disciplined in that training, can go out and make in the civilian sector. So this allows them to actually go do that in the civilian sector and then come into our formations to do only the things that we can do in the military, Title 10 operations. Right. And so many of our candidates have prior experience in civilian cybersecurity. They have roles in academia. They've been doing research for a very long time coming into this. But we offer them the capability to do things that you cannot do in the civilian community. And so this actually helps in the resiliency of our national security infrastructure. I mentioned Mansfield, Ohio. We're looking, obviously, at expanding that and doing more. Maryland just got announced coming out of A-10s, going into more roles in security and cyber warfare. So they'll continue to do that. We offer the ability to do red teaming, where we actually go out there and do physical and electronic intrusions in order to get after the vulnerabilities. And then more and more exercises as we open up, these red teams will go out there and challenge the best of them. So when you look at the cyber aggression mission all the way up to network defense and exploitation, you have guardsmen doing that mission today.
Hey, Mike, the Guard is heavily involved in personal recovery, combat search and rescue. And, you know, and for the listeners out there, there's no country that is as determined and has been as dedicated to recovering downed air crew or isolated personnel. We, you know, if as a fighter pilot, if you go down behind enemy lines, you know our country is going to do everything they can to get you out. And the Guard is heavily involved in that combat search and rescue mission. But the Air Force has to really evolve this mission because the ranges and the threats in the Pacific, we have to really relook how we've traditionally done this. And so what comments can you make on the Guard's combat search and rescue evolution?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that there's this tension going on, right? Because combat search and rescue for so many of us was shorter ranges, you know, Europe, even CENTCOM, and now we're going out to large distances, mostly over water. And so that's a tension. So, hey, this is an evolving threat posed by China. It truly is. So the nature of combat search and rescue is expected to undergo significant transformation. China will continue to expand its military capabilities, you know, oppose its assertiveness in the Pacific, and potential conflicts arise in areas where, you know, the search and rescue missions are increasingly complex, a lot more dangerous. So how do we invest in cutting-edge technologies such as unmanned aerial systems, unmanned delivery systems, advanced sensors, the ability for our members to actually stay alive for longer if they're shot down, because it may take us longer to go in there? All those are going through great transformation, and some of it, like changing out the rafts and seat kits and changing out how we supply the seat kits, are actually happening through our test center and in GRIA, as you touched on before, funds to make sure that when we go out there, we have the best kit available to get them back. But at the end of the day, it does come back to the people. You know, airframes, technologies will evolve, but without the trained personnel, we lack the flexibility, the insight required to meet evolving mission demands. So I believe in the experience of the Guard. I rely on our combat rescue formations, our PJs to our HC-130, you know, pilots, CISOs, operators, to tell me exactly what they need as we go into this, into different parts of the world. So we're finding the right balance to avoid the collapse of the human side of this equation. How many more do I need, and on what platforms? Can I make it platform agnostic, and can I get to them, and how am I going to get to them under the strictest of conditions? So I think it's working, Gus, and I'll say it that way. But again, it is right in the middle of a transformation right now. Bringing on HH-60 Whiskies to the Guard is great. How do I modernize an HC-130? And then how do I make sure that whoever gets shut down, I can actually go out there and get them and ensure that they're alive and they're the person that I'm going to see? Because as you know, we may only have one shot at it.
You know, sir, and I'll just jump in here as well, because combat search and rescue mission not only is a moral imperative and it's a promise that our nation makes to our airmen, but to be honest, our states use it all the time. If you're a hiker, if you enjoy the outdoors, I can't tell you when I was sitting in the National Military Command Center, every single day we would see the Air National Guard going out and picking up hikers, looking for people who had been lost, looking for folks who were missing. And the combat search and rescue missions were the assets that did that and took care of our civilians and took them home too.
Oh yeah, the 176 up in Alaska is huge. And just some stories, some of them make the press, some of them don't, but we've had PJs jump out of the back of an HC-130 in order to get down there in -60-degree weather to go save people. I mean, it is amazing what they're doing. So when the civilians can't make it out there, when there's no hope for these folks, it is, you know, our PJs and our air crews under very, very extreme weather conditions of Alaska that are going out there. And I tell you, we have active duty PJs volunteering to come and sit alert with our units just to get more experience. So it is a wonderful total force thing. It is active guard and reserve working together to make these things happen.
Those just great Americans, true heroes. So we've talked a lot about the experience that the airmen within the Air National Guard have, but as we all know, our jobs are perishable skills. If you're not doing it on a nearly daily basis, I mean, there's only so much you can rely on that experience to stay sharp. You really still have to actually get out there and go get the reps, go get the sets. And for pilots, that means flying hours. And these accounts are going down big time when we look at things, especially with an historic trend. And I'll also say, especially when we look at it in comparison to what our Chinese rivals are doing as well, right? They are flying a lot more than American fighter pilots across the total force, whether or not that's the Guard component or the active component, the reserve component. So how are you seeing these constrained budgets impacting the Air Guard?
Oh, it is a budget issue. It's a huge one, and it's a flying hour program, which you talked about, and flying hours are extremely important. They build readiness for the Air Force. And it's not just local flying hours, but the work we do with our allies and partners. The flying hour is necessary to go have those touch points as we go over there and really execute operations of the state partnership program. The erosion over the years, the budget issues, trying to fund the research and development for the new capabilities, trying to fund the modernization and doing that stuff has cut into all three components flying hour program. And so that's what's going on. You know, I mean, as part of the budget side, you know, the RAND studies have looked at this. Yes, it is less expensive to operate in the Guard and Reserve, but that's because of our experience. But there comes a defining line of what the least amount I can do. And so we've actually been below that, well below the flying hour requirement. And simply put, we need money. The Air Force needs money. We've made tough decisions recently to fund research and development for the new capabilities, but the resulting cuts to flying hour program funding directly impact future aircraft availability, reducing performance and hindering capacity support the national objectives of our nation. And so we continue to advocate for full funding of the flying hour program to build and maintain the readiness of flying operations so that, just like Gus understands, so that the A3s of the world can provide that capability to the joint force.
The fact that this is a budget drill is so disheartening. And when it comes to looking at how the flying hour impacts experience, you need flying hours to grow that experience. And actually, the vast majority of these new pilots are in the active component. And if they don't get the flying hours they need, and if they don't have the instructor pilots and the experienced supervisors to fly with, then they will never reach that threshold of experience that they can then rely upon. And here's why it matters, because we know from historical case studies that inexperienced combat pilots are far less mission effective and they have far higher loss rates. People die when they're not experienced, and it has a direct impact on our force and our total combat outcomes. So this is something that we really need to look at. General Guastella, what else do you have to add on this?
You know, what a mess we've found ourselves in as the Air Force, right? Because you described earlier a tremendous reduction in capacity over the years, but you'd think, well, they got smaller, so at least they're ready, right? Well, unbelievable that we're flying, Mike said, we're flying, our fifth gen pilots are flying fewer hours a month than Chinese pilots. It's unbelievable, right? And it's absolutely due to a lack of funding. And it's also, and tied together with that, it's an aging fleet. When the average age of the fleet is 20, it peaked at over 30 years old, it's coming down a little bit. When you have airplanes that old, they're more expensive to maintain, and you just can't fly them at the same rates as you can a new jet. And then that manifests itself into lower and lower flying for the pilots over time. And yes, you can argue that there are better simulation and there are better ways. There are very good ways to train using a synthetic environment, but that is not a replacement for flying. And unfortunately, we found ourselves in this situation where we're flying less and we don't have the opportunities for the high-end training because we're overconsumed. And so if we're going to get after our ambition, and one of our ambitions was stated very well by Secretary Kendall, he wants to optimize for great power competition. And that means we need to be ready for great power competition. And the Air Force recently announced that they're going to reorganize and they're going to focus on this. And many of those organizational changes impact a lot of things, such as the MAGCOMs and how we deploy combat wings. But how does that effort that outlined by Secretary Kendall affecting the Air National Guard, Mike?
Gus, great question. I mean, we were at the initiation of this great power competition as a total force. And so the total force was baked in from the beginning, the active guard and reserve. And the Air Guard has many strengths, as you know. One of them, historically, has been our ability to adapt and adapt quickly. So when I look at the Air Guard, I see a force that is baked in agility and is able to not just adapt to organizational change, but really lead the way and be a model for the Air Force. The great power competition modernization fits into several buckets, and I had to get it right in my mind, so just bear with me for a second. It's people, readiness, power projection, and capability development, or PRPC. Okay. When I talk about our people, obviously they're our competitive advantage, the experience levels, and that's our crown jewel. The value proposition of the Guard is loud and clear as we went through this stuff. Our community ties, our airmen who bring skills from other careers to the mission, and these ties to the states are enduring. You know, we're building a robust program for cyber and intel missions. Cyber Naval Air Superiority is future, leading the way. The Air Force is rolling out the cyber IT warrant officers, and we are in the first cohort to get trained. So we'll be trained right along with our active duty counterparts. When it comes to readiness, we're going to continue on the path to the high-end exercises. How do we get after, you know, the new threats that are out there and the threats that we're seeing, not just today, but the threats we're seeing 2 and 3 years down the road? And so that's what we're doing. At the base and squadron level, you're going to see no notice inspections. Inspectors show up in your base when we're conducting these exercises and actually getting inspecting not just, you know, the inspectors, but inspecting the troops at the ground level so that we have a quality control check in place to make sure that we are getting after this and the details can be finely tuned. You know, to segue from readiness to power projection, this fall, Guard Airmen led the 1st Air Force's Expeditionary Air Base, okay, the XAB, which is really the precursor to a deployable combat wing. It'll be a feature of great power competition for the Air Force. And this XAB landed in the CENTCOM AOR, and the wing commander took command on October 7th, the day that Hamas invaded Israel. So he came in there, and he went from contingency operations, something that he had thought and planned, you know, and exercised with, to immediate crisis response. Think about that from a wing commander level. So postured to support our allies and partners in the region and use air superiority and get after it on day one. So it's been very interesting when you put the Air National Guard at the tip of the spear. And, you know, the Air National Guard deploys in a snap, just at the same timeline as we do in the active duty. And so then, now, so that's that readiness piece, the unit of action piece, and capability development. That's probably the big one. How do we rapidly bring new capability on board to the warfighters? In the Air Guard, as you know, we don't shy away from innovation. You talked about some of the things that we've done with F-16s, and even in the IR realm, when you talk about the Lantern Pod and others. But even without the great power competition, we would continue trying to use our test center to get out there to get fielding recommendations, to do foreign comparative testing on things that our allies and partners bring. And then, of course, using that INGREA money that Congress is so generous with, and thank you very much, in order to field the equipment necessary to deliver combat capability at the edge in the hope that we never have to use it. So those are the things that were that really the great power competition that the Secretary has led and both Chief of Staff of the Air Force and Chief of Space Operations have brought to the forefront.
So, sir, we've talked a lot about some of the challenges that the total force faces, that the Guard faces, that the active component faces. As we look out 5-10 years, what are winning and losing comms, right? What does good look like, and what are some of the indicators are that the service is accepting too much risk?
Can we build a United States Air Force with the combat capability and the capacity necessary to where the joint force is actually saying, I am happy with the size of our United States Air Force, and I am happy with the capabilities that they're bringing, and I am happy with the locations that they're bringing these capabilities, and I have less risk on the force and the human capital piece of this that of the overuse has caused during this time of declining budgets and shrinking the service. So I think that is what winning looks like, is how do I build a stronger Air Force, a total Air Force, a modernized Air Force. Losing, obviously, is the inverse of that. If we continue to have budget pressures on the United States Air Force, if we continue to do this, then what happens to our global presence around the world? What happens to the leadership role that we've had? And are there other leaders in the global realm that start to take over where our United States can no longer be because of this impasse? So I think those are the two things at a macro level we ought to look at. Gus, any thoughts on that one?
No, Mike, you hit the nail on the head. I really like how you phrased that. And I guess the last thing I would say is, you know, and we talked a little bit about, we alluded to rivalry between the active and the Guard. You know, we're a family, meaning it's one big total force family. And the best thing the air component can do, the active duty, the Air National Guard, and our reserves, is team together for the value that air power provides our nation, and not have any kind of infighting and pointing and finger pointing, but really use our collective efforts to elevate our nation's understanding, to elevate the Hill's understanding of the value air power brings, and then advocate for those issues that we described in this podcast. But Mike, you did a phenomenal job across your career and your service as director of the Air National Guard. Give me some of your favorite memories of what you took away.
Oh, Gus, there's so many favorite memories. Hey, flying with Lucky in combat, favorite memory. I mean, you know, going into combat on day one when we invaded Iraq. I mean, the memories are numerous. I've tried to look back, and I really haven't had time. As you know, in the last job you're in, as I'm in this job, it's you kind of sprint to the end. So I figure once I get some downtime, I'll really think about it. I take the, and again, four decades of this, right? The first 20 years was all about being the best combat fighter pilot I could be, was developing leadership skills, was leading, you know, men and women both into combat, but also into training environments and testing their skills and doing all those things. You know, that's really the first half of the career. The second half of career, hey, the best thing is when you and I got together in those large group meetings with the Secretary of Air Force and educated our civilian leadership on what it means to deliver air power for America. So there are so many terrific memories I have. You know, the first 20 was all about delivering air power. We can tell the war stories at the bar anytime we want. And then the second half then is how then do we build an institution of our United States Air Force, and how do we make sure that we get the resources that our airmen deserve and need in order to continue that? So it's been a phenomenal run, Gus.
Awesome.
Well, sir, I just want to publicly thank you for all that you've done in uniform. Not only did I love flying with you in combat, but what you are doing today for our total force, for the Air Force, for the airmen are out there, you have led with integrity, with moral courage, and with vision. So thank you. You filled your father's shoes well. Your dad's service history is amazing, and your son is, as you said, flying Vipers in the active duty today. You and your family have contributed so much to your nation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mike, you know, you're taking off the uniform here pretty soon, but, you know, we still want you in the air power fight. I took my uniform off, and I love being part of Mitchell. And I have a feeling that Zatar and Lucky and the Mitchell Institute will be talking to you about participating in events like this or other things in the future. And we sure hope you can do that.
Hey, Gus, as you know, I'm focused right now on literally getting to the end of my career. And then I'm going to take some time, and Diane and I are going to go off and spend some time together and do that stuff. So call me in a few months.
we'll give you a little time, you know, and hopefully I can hear some of those war stories over an adult beverage here in the fall. I believe we have something on deck.
Awesome.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. And I have to admit, I've got a little bit of sand in my eye, you know, because fighter pilots don't cry, right? General Lowe, thank you for all that you've done.
You're welcome. And go guard.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you heard today, don't forget to hit that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like us to explore further. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great Aerospace Power kind of day. See you next time.